I am very pleased to have as our guest preacher this morning my good friend Jess Dahlman. Jess is a psychotherapist in private practice in Mount Horeb. And to help you get a little acquainted with them before they come up here to speak, I want to read for you just a little bit from their website. As a psychotherapist, they write, I support people recovering from stress and trauma, in developing a sense of purpose, in building positive and supportive relationships, and in living a fulfilling life. I believe that each person has access to a wealth of knowledge about how to grow and heal. Ultimately, I facilitate my clients' access to their own inherent natural wisdom. In 2015, Jess founded the Natural Wisdom Counseling Service, the service which, according to their website, is dedicated to supporting people of all ages in their path towards leading a healthier, more resilient, integrated life. Healthy, integrated people, they say, will build communities that are healthier, more resilient, and more connected to the places where they live. Which, by the way, is pretty much what we try to do with different language here in church. Now, immediately after Jess's sermon, we will have our usual time for responses and questions. So if something that they say this morning catches your attention, make a mental note of it and ask them about it later. And then after church, during the fellowship time, Jess will be available for any other questions you might have. There is a really interesting display set up with all sorts of things that she will be obligated to explain to us why they are there. So spend some time looking at that, and Jess is eminently approachable. So ask her anything that you want, and she will take very good care of you, I'm sure. So as I said, Jess, I am very pleased to have you here this morning. The chair is yours. You can sit that way you want it.
Eminently approachable. I've never.
Well, you are.
Also approachable. Also approachable. All right, I'm gonna just go back here for a second. You had put down a couple of readings for me that I had sent you, so I want to open to Matthew 5:3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then Luke 17:14. When he saw them, he said, go, show yourselves to the priests. Excuse me. And as they went, they were cleansed. One of them, when he saw he was healed, came back, praising God in a loud voice. He threw himself at Jesus' feet and thanked him, and he was a Samaritan. Jesus asked, were not all 10 cleansed? Where are the other 9? Was no one found to return and give praise except this foreigner? Then he said to him, rise and go, your faith has made you well. So, I must admit that I'm used to speaking for a long period of time. I can talk quite a bit. My sessions with clients as a counselor are usually 45 minutes, and I've been encouraged to acknowledge that, you know, about 15 minutes of direct talking is good, and then I'll open it up to more of a conversational style like Brad has been doing for the last number of months here for you all. In these two verses, a big part of what I look at and what I see and what I feel is really about this concept of loving our neighbor. You know, what does it really mean to love our neighbor? Who is our neighbor? Whether they're foreigners, whether, you know, they are meek, whether they, like, our neighbors are our neighbors, regardless of how they show up, or whether they have been cleansed as lepers already or not, or whether we are aversive to them or not. And underneath a lot of this and what I work with in my counseling practice is really about navigating fear. And the way that people around us trigger fear in us. Whether that's the fear of difference, the fear of the unknown, like I don't understand why you act this way when I act this way, or whether that is the fear of things that are painful. Unfortunately, things are not getting less painful in our society or our world. And one of my favorite authors, John O'Donohue, I'm not sure if you all are familiar with John O'Donohue, but he's he was a pastor and spiritual leader in Ireland before he passed away. And he did a lot of weaving between Celtic beliefs in the value of nature and the beauty of nature with spiritual beliefs as well. My private practice is called Naturalism Counseling. I really deeply believe in the power of nature to support healing. And I was raised with that. You know, I was raised in communities that saw the outdoors as a temple, not just the church as a temple. And the more I've spent time with nature, the more I've really seen in other people the way that nature opens spiritual doors for people, reflects back to them beauty and hope and metaphors about growth and the changing seasons of our lives. John has written quite a bit about fear and about working through fear, especially on spiritual terms. So one thing that John O'Donohue writes about in his book, Walking in Wonder, he says that fear is a force that can turn that which is real, meaningful, warm, gentle, and kind in your life into devastation and desert. It is a powerful force. Fear derives its power also from time and from the fragility of the human heart. My main role as a counselor is to sit across from people expressing their deepest pains. And like you had said around the parallels of the words I use for my counseling practice and the church, I believe that the church tries to do that for each other as well. I work a lot one-on-one with people, but I've actually always really believed in the power of groups, in group healing. And I've done a few different things in the community to try to address this sense of group. You know, announcing groups, doing therapy groups. I was a main figure in developing the Mental Health and Wellness Fall Festival that we had a couple years ago and last year, but did not have this year, because I really believe that when people come together and share our stories, we have a different kind of commitment to each other. We have the opportunity to hold each other accountable. We have the opportunity to comfort each other. And since the pandemic especially, that has gotten a lot worse. And the isolation that people experience is a lot worse. And I couldn't help but, you know, start thinking and be like, hey, Brad, What about this possibility of, you know, coming to the church instead of trying to get people to come to counseling? Because there's so much overlap, there's so much power, and you're already a community. You already have access to each other. There is a certain kind of commitment of you coming here that is different than trying to persuade people to build a new community or come to a new group. So I'm hoping that this, you know, this little experience will be of value to you all. Besides acknowledging fear, John O'Donohue also acknowledges the value of nature, like I mentioned before. And in particular, he acknowledges the beauty of nature being a source of inspiration and of hope and of longing. You know, the opening call to worship was about, you know, longing for God. And it's really in our longings that we develop our sense of hope. And it's the seed of our creativity and how we create new possibilities. John wrote a long time ago, before he even passed away, that the death of every animal and every person creates a kind of invisible ruin in the world. And that as the world gets older, it becomes more full with these invisible ruins and vanished presence. So from a spiritual perspective, John was writing years ago about how trauma essentially accumulates for us. That the more trauma we have, the more stress we have, the more violence we have, the more imminent doom in the news, the more it accumulates this sense of loss and fear. And our society reflects that in the way that the news is done. It reflects that in the way that the media relies so much more on headlines that are clickable than our headlines that are true. So what do we do with that? If there's more and more fear, and there's more and more pain, but as humans we have a limit for being able to tolerate that, how do we really move through that? How do we build connection if the person across from us is suffering, especially if there's a suffering that we can't do anything about? It's a little bit of a rhetorical question, but I think it's the place where a lot of spiritual communities get stuck. What can we actually do? Especially as we reach our own personal limits of, I'm exhausted. I have my own family members with mental illness. I have my own people that I've lost to tragic death. I have, you know, my own fears or paranoias that I have to carry. And over time, I've really found that my counseling practice has helped me come back to my spiritual practice. Because of specifically the ability to sit in front of somebody and witness their pain without it swallowing me. That's not a common practice that we're taught. And I think a lot of people crave that in themselves and each other. Because we see it amplifying. It gets more and more overwhelming. Like John had talked about it, you know, kind of accumulating over time. A lot of people really like to hear my story. Like, what? Who are you? Where do you come from? Why is this important to you? And it's really hard for me to tell my story without acknowledging my history. My grandfather was actually a UCC pastor himself, so I have a lineage of being in the church. I grew up with two parents as veterinarians, so I was surrounded by animals and hunting and fishing and in a rural community. And that really forged my foundation in believing that reflective and contemplation is valuable. Whether it's contemplation practice in a church environment, or whether that's journaling, or whether that's counseling for some people. And as much as that's an individual practice, we actually need each other as mirrors. One of the things that I work with people is that we aren't always aware of our own patterns or behaviors. You know, you said at the beginning that I was imminently approachable, and I was like, wow, I haven't heard that reflected back to me. That's a different mirror, Brad. Thank you. The only reason I think that was able to be mirrored back to me is because other people have also been willing to mirror back to me all the times that I was not approachable and to give me some hard feedback about being intimidating or, in particular, being too rushed in my speech, being too urgent in moving on or making my point known without necessarily hearing their points. Trauma always moves fast. And the internet doesn't help us with that, or the news or social media, the way that this rapid stream of information comes through keeps us moving fast. The practice of coming to church is a practice of slowing down. Right? The practice of prayer is a practice of contemplation. It's literally working with your bodies in a way that's opposite to the urgency and fear that's being fed to us constantly. So I do believe that the church can be a refuge, especially in a time where there's a lot of fear. But then how do we bring the practice of slowing down back into the rest of our life? One of the most recent trauma therapies that I've done talks a lot about the presence of absence. What are we missing in our lives? And some of that is about attachment trauma, so specifically the absence that many of us experienced at different points as children, you know, the absence of warmth when we needed it, or the absence of understanding when we sought to be understood, or the absence of food for some people, right? Like the presence of absence, the needs that were left unmet. And those needs are always relational needs. That's the like you and me needs. It doesn't matter if there's always food on the table if nobody's there to eat it with me. The presence of absence. And when it comes to loving our neighbors, I think a lot of us have come to realize that there's quite a bit of an absence of even experiencing our neighbors, of being able to stay in conversation or engage with them. Whether that's because, you know, this year I moved into an apartment complex. I don't know my neighbors very well. We're not on similar schedules. I don't see them coming and going. But there is an absence. There's a palpable presence of an absence of community in that living space. Even though we have shared spaces, I don't ever see people in those shared spaces, very rarely. And in the few occasions that I have, the management has actually sent emails reminding us that we're not supposed to have that many people in those shared spaces. Yeah. We have a pool. Each household is only allowed to have two guests at the pool under any circumstance. No birthday parties, no, you know, anniversary parties, nothing. No more than two guests per household. There's a very palpable absence. Right. I'd made a note here of another verse that I was going to read, and now I'm like, what was that? James 1:27, that's page 1881. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. The first half of that verse, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless, is this: to look at orphans and widows in their distress. Humans are pain avoidant under most circumstances. We're biologically wired that way. You know, except when we're safe enough to rubberneck and look at that car crash, right? Then we look. But when it's really close to us, a lot of times we pull away. We have a natural, like, I need to protect myself tendency because of our own wiring for self-preservation. And we have to really work with that, to lean in. You know, do you know each other's stories? Do you know the things that break each other's hearts? Do you know about each other's kids or siblings or journeys that they've been on? Do you check in about those things? I think that's a place where I really see people struggle, even if they share, like, oh, you know, my son has cancer. A lot of us forget to follow up and be like, how is your son doing? When's the last time you got to visit? What's the prognosis? You know, there might be some factual, but, like, how heavy is this weighing on you? Is it impacting your sleep? Are you eating well? Right, because those are the things that change when we're under stress, and when we're hurting. Really, in my upbringing, the only place that I really saw people following through like that was in the church. But it wasn't necessarily emotional. A few people could do that, like, emotional ministry, but mostly it was like meal trains. And the church did that really well when I was young. But as I got a little bit older, there were definitely plenty of times where I was like, where's the church? Where's the support? Where's the care? And a lot of it had to do with people not being able to look directly at the pain that my family was experiencing. I understand that better now. I've really spent my whole life trying to, like, what motivates people to lean in sometimes and pull away the vast majority of other times. I'm just going to look at my notes here really quick. Another aspect of really practicing and reflecting on what it means to love our neighbor in such a divisive time, such a divisive world, is really reflecting on this old adage of, there but for the grace of God go I. Again, growing up, when I heard that, people always kind of spoke of it more in a sense of pity. Like, there but for the grace of God go I. Thank God I'm not suffering in that way. Thank God I don't have addictions that are ruining my life or unable to maintain a home for myself or lost my job, or, right? Like, there's pity in it, maybe compassion as well. But the deeper I've gotten into my counseling practice, the more I've really thought of this phrase, there but for the grace of God go I, this belief that actually every single aspect of humanity lives inside of me. Whether that is pure rage, or whether that is pure greed and jealousy, or whether that is deep compassion, or whether that is overflowing love. That every aspect of humanity and every possible version of how it manifests, all of those seeds are inside of me. So when I think of the term now, there but for the grace of God go I, what I'm really trying to meditate on, practice, is this feeling, like not just a thought, but this feeling that like I see myself in you. That many other paths could have brought me down your path. Even when I'm looking at a neighbor that is painful to witness in their experience. They're mirroring part of me, not mirroring the things I don't want to be. And there's a big difference in that when I start to shift that. How do I build more compassion there? How do I build more patience? Not complacency, not condoning, not like you've had a hard time so there's no expectations for you, but that deep compassion of like, I could have ended up there too because that possibility is actually inside of me. I know where my rage lives. I know where my resentfulness lives. I know where my deep, deep heartbreak depression lives. And I know the rest of me too. I can come back to this whole sense of myself as it's mirrored in the reflection of what God and the scripture tries to have us mirror back as far as love and light and possibility go. There's so many different traditions, whether it's the Celtic traditions that John O'Donohue writes about, or whether it's Jungian psychology, or whether it's Native American philosophies, that like we are mirrors for each other. That there's a popular adage of the pot calling the kettle black. It's easier actually to recognize our own patterns by recognizing them in someone else, especially the painful ones. Like, the pot calling the kettle black is about hypocrisy. It's about like, oh, I'm calling you out on your problems, but not necessarily reflecting on my own. And Jesus is known for saying, he who has not had sin can be the first one to throw the stone. There's so many different colloquial terms, spiritual concepts that we're just mirrors for each other. And when we practice with that, even if it's just practicing with nature items, like the ones that are on the table back there, we get to experiment with what it's like to open up to that possibility and when we've had too much and when we need to protect ourselves. But there's choice in that. Instead of like, I always have to be closed because I'm gonna constantly be hurt, or I have to always be open because I'm gonna sacrifice myself for everybody else's benefit. Like, how do I go back and forth? Because trauma, heightened stresses, will make us try to do one or the other. It'll put us on the extremes instead of letting us be whole people. As whole, complex people, we get to go in and out. We get to expand and contract, you know, just like the cycles of the sun and the moon. We can't be one thing all of the time. We have to have variation in order to feel authentic and whole. I'm gonna pause there. Do you have any, I wasn't actually tracking the time, Brad. Do you know where I'm at? Okay, that's what I thought, yeah. I do have something else to share with you briefly at the very end, but I'm going to open it up to questions as far as things that stood out to you, and that can be on the spiritual side of things, or it can be on, the counseling side of things, or the overlap, because I'm really here because I believe in the overlap of these two worlds of mental health and spiritual health. Questions? Yeah, go ahead, Brad. Yeah. That is a good question. A big piece of working with that is actually navigating the fear of conflict and the fear of disagreeing, or in particular, the fear of conflict, especially in Wisconsin, because we're Wisconsin nice, is the fear of being perceived as not nice. And sometimes we're just gonna disagree. So there's a particular set of skills that come with being able to disagree and still have compassion for each other, right? So I'm a queer person. I have plenty of experiences of losing community from the church. You and I were talking about this, that one of the things that was shocking to me when I came out was actually that nobody bothered to proselytize me. They just all disappeared. And I didn't expect that. So it hadn't even registered for me to be afraid of losing my entire community. But now I'm more aware of that possibility, right? So the conflicts that we come into when our fears clash often have to do with whatever our values are, and the way our values are kind of undulating back and forth, and like which value is more important at a time. If we can step back and look at the values, it becomes a lot easier to have conflict over the fact that, like, oh, right now you are valuing like the fear of violence. So safety is the value that you're prioritizing right now. I can get on board with the fact that safety is important to all of us, right? Oh, and right now you're valuing or prioritizing the fear of not being inclusive enough, right? So the value underneath that is really about being open and receptive, or valuing community and connection. Sometimes safety is in opposition to pursuing like an open community and connection. One isn't inherently better than the other. We have to balance them. We have to figure out how to acknowledge what are the safety concerns here in order to really explore what the possibilities are for community and connection. Is that example helpful? Does that answer your question? Ish. No.
Because you're dealing with people who hold their values very firmly, but their fears over losing what they value is even stronger.
Yeah. Somewhere in one of these books, John, let me see if I can find it. I thought I had marked it, but I might not have. It's either 266 or 366. I think it's 266. John identifies that in the Bible, we are told 266 times, do not be afraid. There's a lot to be afraid of, right? We're good at being fearful. Part of that is about practicing the fearfulness. Am I practicing fear, or am I practicing possibility? Right? Because, again, when we come to spiritual practice, really contemplative, self-reflective practice, we have to be able to tell the difference between, like, I'm fearful about this value and living this, like, making sure I live this value, and I'm fearful about how I'm being perceived or my ego, right? So if I can really reflect on what am I actually afraid of? What am I actually afraid of? What is underneath how I'm responding. So for, I'm just going to go there. In churches across the country, there is a huge conflict on whether to support LGBTQ people or not, right? And there's fear on both sides, right? On one side, often there's a big fear around around if we're complacent about correcting LGBTQ lifestyles, that's how people will refer to it, right? If we're complacent around correcting these things, then I'm afraid that I'm going to let these people that I love go to hell. Right? It's about, like, the protection becomes around eternity, right? Which is this amorphous thing. There's ambiguity in the scripture around, like, it depends on how you want to interpret things. Not only are we told 266 times not to fear, the most commonly used word in the Bible is the word love, right? So if the value is love, on one side of love is trying to protect people from themselves, and on the other side of love is accepting people as themselves, right? It's the same thing with a different interpretation. What I have found in clinical counseling practice and in my own spiritual practice is that people have to walk their own paths. I can't protect anyone from themselves. So there's a different kind of acceptance that comes from that that helps me reflect on what love means to me. That each of you have to reflect on your own. Because again, there's a difference between, I'll use an example. I recently had a client come to me concerned about a friend who might be suicidal. There are ethical roles in that, there are legal roles in that, there are institutional things in place around protecting people from suicide. Right? That we're not supposed to let people kill themselves for good reasons, right? Like, the research shows that most of the time people just need support. They need appropriate support and can be helped and can get through that. And she's not in a position to actually prevent anything. This person is currently living very far away. She doesn't have this person's address. It's like, there's a lot of barriers to actually being able to prevent this situation. But she can call this person and say, hey, I was thinking about that thing you said to me the other day, and it made me really worried about you. Can we have an honest conversation? That can be preventative, even if the legal, medical components aren't in place. This is a situation where I can't do anything about it either. It's not in my jurisdiction, even as a mandated reporter and a counselor, right? The relationship of, like, I care about you and I really don't want to see you go, can I help you get through this, is really different than I'm going to control every aspect of your life to make sure that you don't do this. They feel really different to people. I've been on both sides of it as a counselor, where people are horrifically traumatized by the way they've been controlled by the mental health system, and people whose lives have been saved by it and who've been given additional hope and opportunity. In the middle, the intention is love. On one side is support. On the other side is control. So when our fear is about losing control, then we have a much harder time actually finding that middle ground. It becomes more about right and wrong rather than finding connection together. If I'm more interested in really understanding you than being right, or if I'm really more interested in understanding you than having to question what I've been raised to believe, then we're going to be working through fear in community in a different way. But again, there's a lot of distress tolerance that comes with that. It's not easy work. We have to really be willing to look at our fears. Other questions or comments?
It's how they survive.
Mm-hmm.
From the smallest to the largest animal, they have their fears. How do you separate the natural instincts of fear to living a healthy lifestyle and still having a healthy respect for the need of fear?
Absolutely. I'm following you, I think. Yeah. How do we navigate the fact that nature shows us, and we are part of nature, we are animals as well, right? How do we navigate the fact that fear is a natural response in all biological forms? We move towards pleasure, we move away from pain. There's fear responses to actual or potential pain, right? What it really comes down to from a psychological sense is how we slow ourselves down. So for example, each animal responds to fear differently. So one of the ways I might practice with a group of people or with individuals is like, I draw an animal that represents the way your fear shows up for you. Are you like a deer where you are gone? Or are you, you know, more like a rabbit? Are you like a rabbit where you freeze? Right, like how does your fear show up? So first we get to know how it shows up. And then when it shows up, then we get to press pause. So in the mental health world, a big part of what we look at in animals and how animals have taught us how to work with trauma and fear in humans is what we call the orientation response. If there's a big bang at that back door over there, all of you are going to look, right? We orient to something first. Our body will look at it, listen for it, right? Big bang, right? Either it's something that then makes you, then you see, is this a scary thing or not? You're gonna have that surge of like, first, but once you're oriented, then you get to go, yes, scary, no, not scary, right? So there's this millisecond between when something happens and when we actually decide whether it's a threat or not, and then there's another millisecond between how we feel about it, right? That has nothing to do with our judgments or how we think we should respond or how we wish we would respond. This is pure biological reaction, our orientation response. So if I orient to a friendly face, or I orient, you know, out in public to a less friendly face, I'm gonna have different responses. My body is gonna tense. I'm gonna have a reaction. But if I press pause, I can remind myself that I might not know anything about what's going on for that face I perceive as unfriendly. Now, maybe they just got a bad phone call. Maybe they lost a job. Maybe they have a lot of pain that they carry. I don't know what's going on with why somebody might have the expression that they have, but I can interpret it as aggressive or threatening. Or I don't have to. Humans, interpret things a lot more than the animal world tends to. The animal world will go, oh, not a threat, and then they'll move on. But we keep ourselves up at night. We replay that conversation over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Right? Like, we hold on to that potential fear so much longer than the rest of the animal world does. And so that's what I work with in mental health practice, and that would be a longer conversation, but a fear response is not a problem. It's going to save your life. It's there for a reason. It probably has saved your life under multiple circumstances already. It's moving forward. It's checking it in other situations that might be benign. Or, you know, how much of it is what we think is out there versus what is inside this room, right? So from an orientation response perspective, you might have been watching all of the news from yesterday and the protests, or you might have, you know, seen that despite the ceasefire, that there has been some violence in Gaza again, right? Like, we can orient to that, and that's real, and fear is an appropriate response to that, or anger or sadness or like those emotional things as well. But then we can also orient to the fact that you are here right now. These are the relationships that you get to interact with right now. I'm not going to be in Gaza anytime soon. I don't have power there. I might send, like, if I want to, I can send aid, or I can do fundraisers, or I can protest. But right now, in this moment, I get to have some version of a relationship with each of you. And that's what I'm going to orient to. A lot of it has to do with what we're orienting to and how we're present with what's right in front of us. Yeah. I think I have time for one more question, probably, and then I'll pass around something for you all, and then you can talk to me afterwards as well. When it's useful, it's useful. Yeah, we're not trying to get rid of it. We just don't want it to get in the way of connection when connection is there. Yeah, you wanted to say something as well. Yes. Yes, you're correct. Yeah, that observation is accurate. We have the traumas that we personally experience, and then we have vicarious trauma, so the trauma that we take on from being close to people. So like people like me, therapists or nurses, like they're susceptible to vicarious trauma because we feel with the people that we're with. And then there's the secondary trauma of just being in a collective experience. And more psychologists and mental health professionals are talking about the fact that we are in a collective state of trauma. Unfortunately, another layer of that is actually that trauma often makes us, like trauma or high stress, the things that make us go, oh, nothing's okay, nothing's okay, nothing's okay, actually make us revert to more immature parts of our brain. So we act more childlike when we're really highly stressed. And the more childlike we act, the more we pass on these behaviors because we're not responding as maturely as we would like to. And our leadership reflects that. There's a mental health professional by the name of Gabor Mate, who does a lot of addictions work and a lot of ADHD research, and he says that our choice in leadership is a reflection of the immaturity of our society at this point. And that immaturity might not be the whole picture, right? Like, we can, like, as the people in this room, we can act our age, and under high stress, we're gonna have moments where we don't act our age. Under fear responses, we're gonna tend to act younger than we are. And that's just one of the things that we're dealing with, and why coming back to connection is so helpful. Because if I know you've got my back, I'm less likely to act fearful. I'm more likely to act my age if I know that I have support and people who've got my back. I don't want to act my age. Yeah, I've earned it. I have earned it, right? That impulse is real too, because at some point, especially, and it doesn't matter whether you're in your 80s or your 40s or whether, you know, like, a lot of people are just coming to this point collectively where they're saying, I'm too tired. I'm too tired for this. And trauma and fear, those two things, do make us exhausted. They wear us out. They wear us out. Places like this ideally help replenish us. So I am going to pass this little bowl around as an ending, and you're welcome to chat with me more, but this is an example from nature that kind of goes with this idea of, like, how do we work with fear in a way that supports connection? So if you have a wasp allergy, I don't encourage you to touch these. They can cause a wasp allergy reaction. These are called oak galls. Are any of you familiar with oak galls? Couple of people. I've gotten a new fascination with oak galls, and I've gone down this wild rabbit hole with them. Anyway, there's a lot of different varieties. There are these little round objects that form on oak trees. Galls. Galls. Yeah. And oak galls form from little tiny parasitic wasps laying an egg on a branch or a bud or a leaf. If that little egg stayed there, it would eat the wood and damage the tree, right? So the oak tree has a reason to go, this is scary. This could kill me. This could cause me pain, right? Unlike a lot of other species, the oak gall does not kill the wasp egg. Instead, it puts a little bit of resource into surrounding that egg with this gall formation. So the gall is just there for one season, surrounds that little egg, the egg hatches into a larva, the larva has enough to eat inside the gall so that it doesn't damage the tree at all, and then it burrows out. Most of these have little holes where the larva came out. And then it gets to be a wasp for the next season. So it's, you know, we get to orient to what kind of defenses we want to use. Under what circumstance do we need different kinds of defenses? But again, if this is the community that we're working with, if there isn't imminent threat, how can we put just enough resources to the things that might be toxic for us, so that they're still protected and can survive, but don't actually cause us harm? So you're welcome to take one of these or look at them. I'm just gonna pass that around. These different wasps are intimately connected with these oak trees now. It's the primary place that they lay their eggs. And the oak tree has a way to stay in relationship with them without losing too much. Any mushroom foragers in the room while that's being passed around? Any mushroom foragers? Done it a little bit? Well, mushrooms also do a lot of work for tree systems, ecosystems, where trees naturally share resources underground, and it's the mushrooms, the mycelial networks, through the roots. The roots are connected through the mycelial networks, through the mushroom networks, to share resources back and forth. And for some of the research initially thought that the different species of trees were damaging each other, but actually, they just share resources at different times. So the trees that get leaves early are gonna have a surplus and share out. And the trees that have pine needles or have the leaves stay on later are gonna have their surplus later in the season and will share back more in the fall and the winter. Now there's reciprocity in that community experience, even across different species. So there's a lot of role modeling out there. Both John O'Donohue and Robin Wall Kimmerer separately, so from a Celtic perspective as well as from an Anishinaabe indigenous perspective, refer to humans as the younger brothers and sisters of creation. For some reason, we orient to our leaders, the people with like political power, but maybe we can orient to nature a little bit more for our role modeling. And where that spiritual and emotional resource can be in helping us figure out how we actually want to lead, how we actually want to protect ourselves in sustainable ways, and especially when fear is valid, but we need to protect ourselves, but we're working really hard to make sure we don't cause additional harm to others as well. So I'll be back there. I do have business cards back there. I do have some information about like donations or horse sponsorships. If you're interested in learning more about the equine therapy or the nature-based therapy, you're welcome to ask me back there about that as well.